from the capital city of Charleston, West Virginia, this is Inside West Virginia Politics with Mark Curtis. Inside West Virginia Politics is brought to you by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State.
Well, happy weekend, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Inside West Virginia Politics. I'm your host, Mark Curtis. Boy, the 2024 political season is heating up. We have another candidate to introduce you to. I want to introduce you to Nate Kane. He is a Republican running in the 2nd Congressional District. Great to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
You are running in the 2nd Congressional District. That is the one that is currently occupied by Alex Mooney. He's vacating the seat to run for the U.S. Senate. Why do you want to run?
Well, I think that our country right now is in a very dangerous place. I think that we have to focus on correcting where we are at in terms of protecting our civil rights under the Constitution and re-steering our country in that regard. Also, shoring up and strengthening our national security. And then the third thing is opening up the opportunities for prosperity for West Virginians.
You said some interesting things in your press release. I'm going to hold this up. 3-page press release detailing a lot of your concerns about the government and the United States as it stands right now. And one of the things you say is, unlike other candidates running in the district that are part of a political dynasty, you're referring to the Moores, obviously. Riley Moore, the state treasurer, is running for this congressional seat. What is your concern about political dynasties or your bone to pick with that particular family, if you have one?
Sure. Well, I think the problem is when you look at the way our country was set up and the way the founders intended, I don't think they intended for people to be career politicians. And I do see a problem with that. The longer that you are in politics, the more easily corrupted you are. And I think that it's unfortunate that we've basically had this system that has kind of worked that way for so long. But look what happens when we end up with an outsider who has not had political experience, is they don't have all that baggage going with them. And a perfect example of that is Donald Trump. I think he came in and did some really great things in our country, and I hope to be able to do the same thing as a congressman.
You take issues with other things. You say the government, quote, prohibited the free exercise of a religion when it shut down churches during COVID. I didn't like not being able to physically go to my church. Mm-hmm. I watched online, but why do you think the government, why do you claim the government, you know, is interfering with the right to free religion? I mean, gathering in churches, and I go to a church with a huge elderly population, could have been very dangerous.
Well, I think that it's everybody's decision. If somebody feels that they're at risk, they can certainly stay home. But the Constitution is very clear that the government is not supposed to interfere with the free exercise of our religion, and that is exactly what they did. When we allow the government to have that kind of authority in our lives, it puts us into a dangerous position of authoritarianism taking control. And that is not the way it's supposed to be in this country. This is free, you know, this is a free country.
You write further that the government interfered with the right of people to peacefully assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances as they did on January 6th. Do you think that was a peaceful gathering, or at least, I mean, what happened there? Are you defending what happened?
No, I think that there was probably, you know, the majority of the people who were there were peaceful, absolutely. There were obviously some, you know, rebel rousers, some people who resorted to violence and to destruction of property. Those people absolutely should have been arrested, tried. And the problem I have with January 6th is that you had the police that let people in, and that's being shown now and evident, where people walked around inside the Capitol building. They committed no crime other than trespassing, and yet many of these people are still sitting in jail cells in Washington, D.C. for the last 2 years without a speedy trial and without bail.
Another issue you're very concerned about is border security, especially at our southern border. Talk about what you would do.
Well, I think the most important thing that we have to do is we've got to close the border. We absolutely have to finish building the wall. And the other thing that is also a big concern of mine is that if the government of Mexico is not willing or capable of stopping these drug cartels from essentially poisoning the American people, right now, leading cause of death for young people, fentanyl. We have to do something about it, and I do believe that it may require military intervention.
We're down to 1 minute. You propose a very unique idea in your press release. You're talking about developing a West Virginia strategic energy reserve under state sovereignty as opposed to the federal energy reserve. Why would you do that, and what are the benefits?
Well, right now, when we look and see what's happening with all of the manipulation of the energy markets due to the policies of our current administration, I think we need something to protect the people of West Virginia. If we have a national energy emergency, or we have have skyrocketing prices during a very cold winter, how are people going to be able to heat their homes? And I think that we could do something to protect the people of West Virginia by having something like that.
I want to let people know that our viewers know that Nate Kane is he lives with his wife Melody in the Eastern Panhandle in Hedgesville. In terms of your background, so that's your from. Real quick, your website where folks can find out more information about your campaign.
Yes, it's Nate Kane, the number 4 WV.
Nate, it's a pleasure to meet you. Nate Kane,
nice
Republican candidate in what's becoming a crowded field.
Yes.
I should mention Alex Gasparud is also in with Riley Moore. So right now we got a three-way primary. I bet more people jump in the race before next May's primary. Thanks for being with us, Nate.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more of Inside West Virginia Politics after this break.
Inside West Virginia Politics is brought to you by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Inside West Virginia Politics. I'm Amanda Barron. We want to continue our candidate profiles as we introduce you to the folks who are running for the 2nd Congressional District of West Virginia. And joining me now is Joseph Early. Mr. Early, thank you so much for joining us from Bridgeport today.
Amanda, thanks very much for having me today. Looking forward to a good conversation.
It's a pleasure to have you. First and foremost, I would like to thank you for your service. I know that you are a veteran, and looking at your website, I loved this line where it said, as I launch my candidacy for the 2nd Congressional District of West Virginia, some of you are asking, who the heck is Joe Early? And I want to give you an opportunity to answer that question right off the bat. Who are you?
Okay, who am I? Well, you know, I'm born in Montgomery, West Virginia, 1960. I'm going to go ahead and give out a little bit of personal information. So raised in Eastern Kanawha County, graduated from DuPont High School in 1978. After leaving high school, I graduated at the young age of 17 and entered the adult workforce.
And you eventually joined the military. And I wonder, how do you think your military career prepared you for this next phase of your life?
Well, that's it prepared me in ways that I would have never thought I would have to use. And I had the great opportunities during that time frame to excel in the military, like a lot of my cohorts did. And you go through the schools, the military education, and they recognize the natural born abilities that you have, and then they amplify that with military skills.
Talk about what you think you can do as a member of Congress to help with the spread of fentanyl through the communities of West Virginia.
I mean, that's a very good question, because as you know, at this point in time in the Biden administration, every state is now a border state, unfortunately. Every state is impacted. And let me tell you a personal story of just last week. A young man that I know well, that was a friend of my son's, they graduated high school together, passed away.
Oh, I'm so
25
sorry.
Years old, due to this scourge of drugs that we have coming into this country through the poor southern border. And so it has a direct impact on me. I'm still digesting and trying to come to grips with his death. It's only been a week, and I will tell you that I know that I am one of many parents as I walk by that young man's casket. I saw my son there. Even though my son was standing beside me, that could have been my son. So I grieve with all the other parents that have to deal with this kind of tragedy because lack of enforcement of our border that's allowing the scourge of drugs to come in.
Condolences to your family and to your family friends, as it's a tragedy, and so many people, unfortunately, share the same anguish. Also, current events this week also put back on the spotlight another school shooting. Officials say that it was a 28-year-old woman who went into a school, three children and three adults passed away as a result of that school shooting in Nashville. And I want to ask you what your thoughts are when it comes to, obviously the topic will become gun control once again. And I want to ask you your thoughts on that. Is it a gun control issue or is it a people problem that we have? Where do you stand on that?
Amanda, I would tell you that it's a tragedy. I grieve with those parents. There's three children and three adults that were killed in that rampage. This was a criminal activity engaged by a person that obviously has mental issues. And had they not had that weapon as a firearm to do that damage, they would have found another way to do what they did.
The primary field is getting crowded. What sets you apart from the other candidates and the other Republican contenders?
I know the heart and soul of West Virginia. I am a son of West Virginia. I am not a career politician. And what West Virginia is, I've been over 9 counties, mainly in the Northern Panhandle and Western West Virginia in District 2. And I would tell you, what I hear from them is they do not want a resurgent political dynasty coming back into this state that is nothing more than political continuance of a political process out of the DC area.
Mr. Early, it's a pleasure speaking with you. I want to thank you for your time, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up again along the campaign trail over the next few months. It's going to be an exciting time for a lot of races, and I think yours will be one.
And thank you very much for having me on board, and I look forward to seeing the voters of the 2nd District over the next several months.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Take good care.
Bye.
And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Inside West Virginia Politics is brought to you by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State.
And we welcome you back this weekend to Inside West Virginia Politics. Congresswoman Carol Miller has been a busy member of Congress. She joins us live from Washington, D.C. Good to see you. You've had a busy week.
Man, I've had a busy 2 weeks.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I think, you know, the highlight is your trip to Mexico. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of fentanyl here in West Virginia and other drugs coming in. What is your concern? What did you see in Mexico in terms of concerns you about the southern border and the problems that we're having there that's come all the way to West Virginia?
Well, I can be politer. I can tell you what I think. He did a lot of talking at us, and I get the feeling that he thinks that we are working well together on the border and that the fentanyl problem is sort of our problem, but that's not what you hear on the news. He was incredibly talkative and very glad to have us there, but I didn't get the sense that he felt the urgency that we feel. And of course, we're very sensitive in West Virginia to drug addiction. And, you know, too many of our young people are dying. And so, you know, the age of 18 to 49, fentanyl is the leading cause of death. And you know, I come home on the weekends and I go through all the papers because I'm not an online kind of girl. And I'm always looking at the obituaries, and it always breaks my heart when you see these younger ones that are gone. But, you know, it was a very important part of the trip, but we also went to Guyana and we went to Ecuador. And as you know, I have been meeting with ambassadors for over 4 years because I'm old school, and I think it's very important that we always reestablish our relationships, particularly in this hemisphere, with our neighbors, particularly after COVID. I think we all recognize the importance of having relationships with our neighbors and seeing what we can nearshore and friendshore as we move forward. It's so important for us as a country and a leader to continue to reach out to these countries and establish good trade and security and teach them what to do, because they are an experimental democracy as well. They are trying hard to do better and to be good democracies, and our leadership is important.
Well, I know you talked about a lot of those issues with the U.S. Trade Ambassador this week before Congress, Catherine Tai. She appeared before the Ways and Means Committee. So we've touched on that. Now, let's talk about the Mountain Valley Pipeline as our last question of this interview. Okay. You proposed a bill this week or an amendment that would allow completion of the Mountain Valley Pipeline natural gas. How important is that?
It's extremely important. I mean, it's 94% of the way completed, and it's been approved, and it's the bureaucratic red tape and the unjustified legal challenges that continue to go on. And so my amendment basically would help deliver natural gas in months if we can get it finished. If we can move the judicial court into the DC out of the fourth, I think it would be a fairer thing to do in order to make this happen. And honestly, the pipeline will sustain about 5,800 jobs and $5.9 billion in economic activity in West Virginia and Virginia. And one of my staff members looked up the stat and said that, I mean, this goes all the way down into Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. And he said right now in Charleston, South Carolina, they're paying more for gas than they are in California. That's ridiculous. So I really think it would help stop the endless judicial review on the projects and just get it done. It's time.
All right, we'll see what happens. That's been an ongoing project. I know both of our U.S. senators have been trying to get it across the finish line as well, so we'll keep an eye on the Mountain Valley Pipeline situation. Again, we want to thank Congresswoman Carol Miller, Republican from the 1st District of West Virginia. As always, good to see you. Stop by when you're back at home.
Thank you. It's great to see you, too.
Likewise. We'll have more of Inside West Virginia Politics after this break.
Inside West Virginia Politics is brought to you by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State.
And we welcome you back to our final segment this weekend on Inside West Virginia Politics. We still continue to dissect the 2023 legislative session here in West Virginia. I want to introduce Kelly Allen. She's the executive director of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Great to have you on the program, as always.
Thank you.
Well, I've had Democrats on, Republicans on, different analysts on, reporters on. What are your thoughts? How would you grade this session, first of all?
I think this session really squandered a significant opportunity to make up for years of austerity through flat budgets. You know, we've had about 4 years of flat budgets. This year we had the revenues that we really needed to make investments in things like pay for correctional officers, making up lost funding for childcare affordability. We had thousands of families that just lost their childcare subsidies, essential workers, loss of funding for higher education over time. And this session really presented an opportunity to make up lost investments. And instead, you know, all of that revenue was set aside for tax cuts that will overwhelmingly go to the state's wealthiest households.
Well, the other side argues that this is the people's money. We had a billion-dollar plus budget surplus. Rather than keep that surplus and sit on it, the money should go back to the taxpayers. Your thoughts on that?
Well, looking at the budget, after adjusting for inflation, this year's budget is about $550 million less than the last pre-pandemic budget in fiscal year 2019. So that means we're able to do about 10% less with the state budget than we were able to do back then. So that's why we're seeing all these crises. That's why we're seeing a state of emergency in our correctional facilities. That's why we've seen erosion of the Promise Scholarship and different things where the budget just can't go as far as it used to. And with the tax cuts, you know, that was chosen over those investments of things that we were able to do a few years ago. And while most households will see a few bucks per paycheck from the tax cut, I think they'll be more impacted by what we're not able to do anymore. We're not able to, you know, get good teachers in the Eastern Panhandle because of low pay. We have thousands of families that lost their childcare subsidies. So I think most households will see the harm of less public investment more than they'll see the benefit of a few extra bucks in their paychecks.
Let's talk about the thing that a lot of public employees are concerned about, and that's PEIA. The legislature voted to increase their premiums by an average of 26%. However, there are meetings this week where the PEIA board, finance committee, and so forth may change that. There's possibilities of, instead of raising premiums, raising copays and deductibles and other things like that to try and mitigate some of the impact on PEIA. Your thoughts on what should be done?
Well, on net, no matter which plan is chosen, West Virginia public employees are still going to see an average increase of about 26% in their health care costs. And I think that's another example of these years of austerity, right? After 4 or 5 years of flat budgets, after holding PEIA costs steady but never making more state investment in them, we're getting whacked with this 26% increase in health care costs. And we're seeing that in other areas too, you know, wages for public employees and other things that I mentioned earlier. So I think this is just an example of what flat budgets and not making public investments will do. It's always going to come back to hit us.
I want to look ahead because there are triggers. This isn't just a one-time thing, tax cuts this year. There are triggers in the budgets over the next several years that could cut the income tax even more by 10% each of these years. What is your long-term concern, big picture here?
I think it's really concerning. I mean, overall, the personal income tax makes up over 40% of our general revenue budget, and we're chipping away at that. And like you said, the triggers are automatic in future years. So if we see any revenue growth in future years, instead of being able to put that towards PEIA or towards wages for public employees or towards economic development or anything else, future legislators will be handcuffed by these triggers that will be ratcheted in automatically, regardless of whatever the budget needs might be in future years.
I remember when I first came here 8 years ago, we were dealing with $500 million budget deficits for each of the first 2 years I was here. Now we have a budget surplus. We have this up and down roller coaster economy in West Virginia, a lot of it due to severance tax in the fossil fuel industry. What happens if we have another bust?
Well, that's why it's so dangerous, I think, to enact these big sweeping tax cuts when times are temporarily good. You mentioned the severance tax. We had a lot of federal aid coming into the state. So a lot of the factors that buoyed this surplus are really temporary. And like you said, the last time we did big tax cuts in the mid-2000s, we did a big cut to the corporate net income tax that eventually led to these big, you know, $500 million plus budget holes that we saw later. That's why we've seen cuts in higher education and all these things. So we're really concerned that could happen again.
Real quick, your website so folks can get more information.
WVPolicy.org.
All right. We want to thank Callie Allen, Executive Director of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, for joining us. Always interesting to speak with you. We'll have you back soon. Okay. And thank you for watching Inside West Virginia Politics. Don't forget, we are a podcast. Download us from your favorite podcast vendor. We'll see you back here next week. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Inside West Virginia Politics. You can hear more from state, local, and federal lawmakers each and every Sunday morning on WOWK-TV in Charleston, WBOY-TV in Clarksburg, WDVM in the Eastern Panhandle, WTRF in Wheeling, and WVNS in Beckley. You can also find a new episode of the Inside West Virginia Politics podcast right here on this feed every Monday morning. If you like the show, make sure to leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts.
Inside West Virginia Politics is a Nexstar Media Group production, hosted and managed by Mark Curtis. Inside West Virginia Politics is recorded and edited inside the studios of WOWK-TV in Charleston, West Virginia. All rights reserved.